Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masterson. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and go to Beirut and speak with Rami Khoury, who's a Palestinian, Jordanian and US citizen whose family resides in Beirut, Amman and Nazareth. He is the editor-at-large of the Beirut-based Daily Star newspaper, which is published throughout the Middle East with the International Herald Tribune. And he is an internationally syndicated political columnist and author. And he was in Europe when the Israeli-Lebanese conflict broke out and has just gotten back into one of the few people who's trying to actually get into Beirut, having taken a harrowing car ride from Damascus to Beirut over a road that is being bombed. We'll also hear from Milton Viost, who's covered the Middle East as a journalist and scholar since the 1960s. He was a New Yorker's Middle East correspondent, and he has written a book. His latest book is Storm from the East: The Struggle Between the Arab World and the Christian West. And we'll also then talk to Jahan Salehi, who was born in Iran, and he is raised, educated here in the United States. He was the managing director of European operations of the Los Angeles Times Syndicate, and he is now heading up a new news syndicate called the International. It's called Agence Global, and he is currently their international director. It's a news syndicate that specializes in the Middle East. And let's begin with Rami Khoury, who's a Palestinian, Jordanian, and a U.S. citizen whose family resides in Beirut, Amman, and Nazareth. He's editor-at-large of the Beirut-based Daily Star newspaper, which is published throughout the Middle East, and he's an internationally syndicated political columnist and author. He was in Europe when the Israeli-Lebanese conflict broke out, and apparently you've just made a harrowing trip across the from Damascus into Beirut on the highway that's being bombed. Rami Khoury, could you give me a sense of what you saw on the way in? And obviously you took a chance.
Well, there was a little bit of a chance, yeah. I mean, we talked to a lot of people who had done this, and we left Amman at around 8 o'clock in the evening, the night before last, and we decided to do it at night. And it was kind of strange because we were literally the only car going into Lebanon at a border crossing, which is usually very busy. And we got in around midnight crossing the border and from Damascus to Lebanon and across the Lebanese border. And the scariest part was the first half an hour in Lebanon crossing the Bekaa Valley, because there was both reports of Israeli bombings that day there, but also we saw the charred remains of several large buses and a large truck. And I think that was the truck that had been bombed the day before, carrying flour, I believe it was. So this was the kind of creepy to be, you know, the only car on the road and seeing these bombed-out carcasses hit by Israeli planes. But then after about half an hour, we were actually then up into the mountains, the anti-Lebanon mountains and then the Lebanon mountains, and there we felt much safer because that area had not been, that's one of the areas that Israel had not bombed, one of the few areas in Lebanon. And then it took us about 7 hours altogether from Amman to Beirut. We got home around 3 in the morning and we were glad to be back.
So let me ask you then, obviously it seems counterintuitive that to bomb people into liking you or even submitting to your will, I don't quite know how that's achieved. And President Bush himself has referred to the fragile Lebanese democracy. So is this whole thing backfiring in the sense that prior to this war, the Lebanese seemed to resent Hezbollah and Syria? They got rid of Syria, and now isn't it basically being reversed?
Well, I think this will have an element of backfire against Israel and the United States for sure. I mean, Israel is militarily very strong and has unlimited American assistance, including just yesterday the decision to send priority shipments of precision bombs to Israel from the American arsenal. So Israel has the political green light and an open supply line from the United States. So it can create incredible damage and wreak havoc in Lebanon. It can hit some of the Hezbollah positions clearly very hard and with overwhelming superiority. But the problem with that is that in modern history, over and over, it has been learned by rational people that overwhelming military power will not resolve an essentially political problem where the adversary is either a guerrilla organization or a political movement with mass support among the grassroots of that country. And if you're trying to invade that country militarily, you will not prevail. And the Americans learned this in Vietnam, the Russians in Afghanistan, the French in Algeria, and now the Israelis should be learning it in Lebanon. What's really weird is that Israel has done this 3 or 4 times before. So I think there's an element here of Zionism shedding a little bit of rationalism and acting with a bit of hysteria, which is compounded by the sort of fellow hysterical actors in the White House and the neocons driving this policy. It's a very peculiar policy for Israeli people who are otherwise very intelligent, very capable, very diligent, and they're very serious people, and they're very productive and efficient people, very impressive in so many ways. How they can be so blind to this is peculiar, and I think that's an important question that we have to answer.
Well, perhaps an answer, I was going to say, Ramy Curry, I say perhaps an answer to that question is that this situation is being driven by the passions of the Israeli people. And if you had a general like Rabin or Sharon even, or Ehud Barak, you've got two military neophytes in there, Ehud Olmert and the defense minister, labor leader, Amir Peretz. And I think, you know, they're basically being driven by the passions of their people rather than taking, and as I say, a general could perhaps tampen down these passions and not react in this knee-jerk way that appears to be counterintuitive.
I think there's several things going on here. One is that you have this new leadership, the Kadima Party, having the feeling that it has to kind of prove itself. And in Israel, the way you prove yourself is you kill Palestinians and you occupy Arabs and you demoralize, dehumanize, degrade, occupy, marginalize, and generally humiliate entire Arab communities, whether directly under your occupation in Palestine or in neighboring Arab countries. Unfortunately, that's been their modern tradition. So that's one element. The other one is that Israel feels existentially threatened because you have Hezbollah capturing two Israeli soldiers and Hamas capturing one Israeli soldier. So the capture of three Israeli soldiers by two resistance groups, north and south, has presented to Israel what it sees as a kind of existential threat. Now, this is, you know, hysteria by anybody's account. The reality is that this is a political dispute and it must be resolved in a political way. For Israel to strike out like this with American support, I think is a strong hint that this is not really about just a couple of soldiers or about some rockets coming over the border, that there's something deeper going on here. And I think the explanation probably is linked to Condoleezza Rice's trip. She leaves the United States today to fly to the Middle East. She's only flying to Israel, but she's spearheading, I think, what many people see as a desire of the United States to use it and Israel's military force to fundamentally change the political map of the Middle East and wipe out all these groups that are resisting it and defying it, and change governments in countries like Iran and Syria that are doing the same. So I think the explanation is in that context rather than the narrow context of some rockets or a couple of kidnapped soldiers.
Well, I think that that Condoleezza Rice was very, very brittle at her press conference on Friday. I think indicating that I think most people throughout the world and perhaps in the United States can see the obvious, which is that the United States, the lone superpower, is a helpless giant sitting around waiting in effect for Israel's permission to seek a ceasefire. So that reinforces all these ideas that the tail wags the dog. But we have clearly, what's happened since the soldiers were grabbed is far, far worse, because what you have here is civilians being killed in Lebanon and civilians being terrorized and killed in Israel, and that's a new phenomenon. I don't think anybody wants to live in a city where rockets rain down indiscriminately and bombs rain down. So it's past that point in effect. So what's the sense of? I can't understand how Israel has any interest in a multicultural. They obviously have an interest in a multicultural Lebanon and not an Islamic Lebanon. So where's that stand? Is you're Lebanese? And we know if the president referred to it as a fragile democracy. What's your sense of how thin that reed is, Rami Khoury? I think we just lost him. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with Rami Khoury, who was in Beirut, and he just gotten into Beirut from taking a harrowing car ride from Damascus over a road that had been bombed. Rami Khoury, you're back?
Yeah, I'm back.
Give me a sense of where this fragile democracy that you're living in stands now. If the unintended consequences of this war has been to put Hezbollah and the radicals in the driving seat.
It's really a question that's going to be answered by, I think, three concentric circles. One is local events within Lebanon. The second one is regional dynamics between Lebanon, Israel, Syria, Iran, possibly others in the region. And the third one is what does the United States really want in the Middle East and how is it going to use its power? Those three concentric circles interact at many places, but most importantly, they interact almost totally in Lebanon. And this has been a fragile democracy since its birth in the middle of the last century. And part of the reason why the central government here cannot go to the south and impose its will is because repeated Israeli attacks have emasculated the central government, and that has led to the rise of Hezbollah. So I think the answer in the final analysis is if the outstanding political grievances the legitimate grievances of Israelis, Lebanese, Syrians, everybody, can be addressed simultaneously or at least sequentially within a single diplomatic context, I think you can look to a situation where Lebanon can be stable and calm and peaceful and not invaded by Israel every 7 or 8 years. Israel can live in security and stability and recognition. And the sort of radical Islamic movements that are sweeping this region would subside if you had a fair resolution of the Palestine problem. So these are all issues that are linked. Any domestic issues, of course, good governance, corruption, that kind of thing. These are all linked in the eyes of the ordinary person in this region, and that's one of the reasons why you've had these Islamist movements growing so rapidly and yet becoming so credible while governments become increasingly less credible and less effective.
Well, we know that there's this ironic situation in the world where, in effect, weak states are more threatening than strong states, and Afghanistan was a failed state that incubated al-Qaeda. Iraq was a weak state held together by a thug. We removed the thug, and now we may have a failed state in Iraq. If the Israelis and the neocons get their way to take down the Assad regime, you might well have another failed state in Syria where the Muslim Brotherhood take over. So it seems that our policy generally in that part of the world has not been to buttress and support moderates, but it has had perhaps the unintended consequence of marginalizing moderates. So do you see the whole region careening? I mean, it's a region that seems to have this Hobson's choice between theocrats and autocrats.
Well, that... Yeah, I think that is one of the dilemmas. We've had 6 decades of autocratic, sometimes despotic rule, with grievous aggressions by Israel and the Americans, largely supporting both the Arab autocrats and the Israeli predators. And this has created huge tensions within our societies, and finally people turn to their God when they have no other outlet in civil society or normal politics or human decency. They turn to religion and turn to religious movements and political movements that use religion as a rallying and a motivating cry. And now the situation is, as you open up these societies a bit and have democratic elections, which George Bush has been pushing for, you get the Islamists winning the elections. And then the U.S. says, no, we can't accept Islamists winning elections like in Palestine and Hamas. And that just gives even further pressure. So you have this terrible cycle where almost everything the United States does is weakening the moderates and rational centrist people, bolstering and the United States is left in a position now where Condoleezza Rice is flying out to the Middle East today to talk to a bunch of, and then meet for a meeting in Rome on Wednesday. And the only people she can talk to in this region are a few Arab governments like the Saudis, the Egyptians, and a couple others, who have zero impact on the people that she's trying to deal with, which is Hezbollah, who have almost zero impact on the Syrians, who are an important interlocutor, who are in great tense relationships and fearful relationships with Iran, which is a great important power in the region that has to be dealt with, and that these countries, these Arab leaderships, have very little credibility with their own people. So the situation is actually getting much worse, and with every new phase, the current history with the Iraq war, with the U.S. rejecting Hamas's democratic election, with now this giving the green light for the war in Hezbollah, you're ratcheting up the sentiments of anger, and it's more than just anger, it's a sense of humiliation and degradation among ordinary Arabs who feel that they're treated so badly, so unfairly, and discriminated against, and with double standards and hypocritical policies by the United States. And this just accumulates and accumulates and accumulates, and this is what you're seeing: Hezbollah now fighting against the Israelis, and huge numbers of people all around the Arab world supporting Hezbollah. So we've got to figure out how to get out of this cycle. That you don't. I mean, there is no military solution. Many people support Hezbollah, but I would remind everybody that neither Hezbollah nor Israel is going to solve this problem through guns.
Well,
we've got to find a diplomatic solution which requires policies that treat both sides equally as people with equal diplomatic and national and human rights. And this situation, Condoleezza Rice is coming out here as the cheerleader and the armorer and the supplier of Israel. And she's going to get nowhere. She's just going to make things worse.
Well, they already, I'm afraid, the lone superpower looks embarrassingly helpless. And there's also, in the open mic session that took place at the G8 conference, where President Bush was speaking off the cuff to Tony Blair, he said, and it's pretty clear, he said that Kofi Annan should lean on the Syrians to lean on the Hezbollah. And so it's a de facto recognition on the president's part that you have to talk to Syria, and of course to the United States and Condoleezza Rice, that we don't talk to evil. We don't talk to Iran, we don't talk to Syria, we don't talk to North Korea. That's our policy. So here he is, he's recognizing you need to talk to these guys, at least Kofi Annan does, in order to get something to happen. So just in closing, Rami Kuri, it seems to me that asymmetrical warfare is such that simple IEDs can tie down the best army in the world in Iraq, and the Hezbollah's rockets will continue to get extended range. So I can't see, if they do take all the land south of the Litani River, it would be a very short-term fix, even if you could hold onto that land. So give me a sense in closing what this game plan is here that is supposed to be that the Israelis create the buffer, then somehow the Lebanese army and a group of multinational troops come in and secure this buffer, and this whole thing will have been solved or resolved. What's the chance of that flying?
Well, it's about as much as you're accepting to buy some beachfront real estate in Florida that I'd like to sell you. I mean, it's just not going to fly. It's not going to fly because the group Hezbollah is a symptom of a problem, and is not necessarily the sole cause of that problem. It is a symptom of a recurring problem between Israel and Lebanon, between Israel and the Palestinians and other Arabs. And if they beat up Hezbollah and capture some of its armaments and drive it from the south, this is a guerrilla movement. It's a national resistance movement. It's a popular social mobilization movement. They will simply blend back into the population and lie low, and then they will come back in 2 months or 5 months or 3 years with much, much fiercer weapons, determination, and popular support if the underlying problems that gave birth to Hezbollah are resolved. So using military force, whether your own, if you're Israel, or bringing in international troops or having the Americans support you, military force will not provide you with the security that you want if the underlying political one. And I think the grand plan has to be, and this is what some of the more rational people like the French and others are talking about, is let's talk about an international military force, certainly in South Lebanon, to protect both the Lebanese and the Israelis from each other. But let's talk about us having the underlying problems, which is exchanging prisoners, demarcating the border, ending Israeli occupation of Arab land, not having Hezbollah fire rockets at Israel or Israel attack Lebanon, and then dealing with the Arab-Israeli issue in a comprehensive manner to truly deal with the underlying questions and solve them, which would then solve the problem. So that, I think, is the best hope that we can hope for. So if there is talk of international force, that has to be linked to a really serious political diplomatic process to solve these problems once and for all.
Thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Rami Khoury.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. We're just speaking then with Rami Khoury, who's a Palestinian, a Jordanian, and a U.S. citizen. His family resides in Beirut, Amman, and Nazareth. He's the editor-at-large of the Beirut-based Daily Star newspaper, and he just got into, one of the few people trying to get into Lebanon. He came in via Damascus on the road from Damascus down to Beirut, which has been bombed. I'm now speaking with Milton Viost, who's covered the Middle East as a journalist and scholar since the 1960s. He was the New Yorker's Middle East correspondent, and his work has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, and the Wall Street Journal. He's written 6 books on the Middle East, and his latest is Storm from the East, The Struggle Between the Arab World and the Christian West. And, of course, at this point, this is the Christians. As far as I know, the only Christians who are excited about what's happening in this otherwise disgusting situation where civilian populations are having bombs and missiles rain down on them, and the military on both sides, both Israel and Hezbollah, don't seem to be taking the brunt of the casualties. The Christian fundamentalists over here are thinking, wow, you know, Armageddon's on the way. They're getting very excited about it. And, of course, Megiddo, ironically, where Armageddon is supposed to take place, is, in fact, in the north of Israel, where some of the rockets are raining down. So in terms of your latest book, The Struggle Between the Arab World and the Christian West, where would you place this latest outburst?
I think that we have to face up to the reality of this, Ian. Clearly, this is a government here in the United States that is conducting its policy toward the Middle East in a way that's totally different from that of its predecessors. All of its predecessors agreed on the premise that peace in and of itself was a goal to be the goal to be sought after, and within the context of peace, it might conceivably be possible to solve some of the political problems that Rami Khoury just talked about. But we have a government now that seems to be totally uninterested in peace. It seems that it is convinced that all of the great problems problems of the world can best be resolved by military force. Where this comes from, I think we have to take into account exactly what you just said. There is a strong evangelical influence that passes through this government, starting from the president. And I think they are thinking in terms. I think the president does think in terms of Armageddon, that this may indeed be the prelude to the second coming of the Lord. I think that it's very difficult for those of us in our society and most societies who are secular to imagine these things. But certainly secular Americans have been fooled over and over again over the course of the last 8 years since or more, I mean, a dozen years since the evangelical right has begun to rise as a political influence. We can't believe what they believe, but that doesn't mean they don't believe it. And I think that that's exactly behind, if not in the forefront of Bush's thinking, certainly in the back of his head, that this is a war between Christianity and its foes, and that's what he's fighting.
Well, if he believes that, he's criminally insane and should be impeached.
You said that. I didn't say it.
I know, but the theology of these people is in a nutshell, is that our world has to end in burning flesh in order for their world to begin. So everything's out the window. It's all gone.
Well, I think a lot of this is out the window. I don't know that under our Constitution this is even an impeachable offense. The president has not proclaimed that he is a Christian crusader, but he has certainly conducted American policy in that direction. He has been telling us he's fighting a war on terrorism. There are many of us who believe here in the United States that everything he does, and there have been certain suggestions of that from what you and Ravi Khoury said a few minutes ago, that indeed all he has done is stir up the terrorists. For every Hezbollah, for every innocent victim in Lebanon, we probably create a half a dozen new foes of the United States, those who despair of resolving any problem in a sensible way and become, if not terrorists, and certainly absolutely immutable foes of American policy. And there is a certain rationality to all that, but there is there is this strain of religiosity that passes through all that we have been doing since George Bush became occupied the White House.
Well, it seems that, as I say, it's the new and deadly phenomenon. We haven't seen this since the Iran-Iraq War, which is civilian populations being indiscriminately killed by unguided missiles raining down on them or bombs causing collateral damage. And in this particular war, it doesn't seem like the IDF or the Hezbollah are suffering anything like the casualties that civilians on both sides are suffering. But you have to also put this in context, that the people of Iraq, more of them have died since we liberated them than have died in all of the Arab-Israeli wars combined.
Or who were victims of Saddam Hussein as well.
Well, that's, yeah, because I don't know how you factor that in, because Saddam did provoke the war with Iran, and that caused a lot of deaths on both sides. Plus, of course, he did attack Kuwait. So he's had it's hard to factor in how many people he's responsible for killing. But unquestionably, on our watch, there's been an enormous bloodletting.
Of course there's been enormous bloodletting, and we don't seem to be terribly troubled by all of this. When I say we, I mean this administration, and it doesn't seem to be terribly troubled by what's happening in Lebanon today. I repeat, this is a total reversal of all policies of all previous administrations, which would have sent out the Secretary of State or some other high official to put a stop to this as promptly as possible. But what we have here is a president who is clearly urging on the Israelis, and I think this is catastrophic.
So, as a Jew, how do you feel about what's happening to the Jewish people?
Well, I take a position which is notably different from that of much of the Jewish community in the United States, and as a matter of fact, in Israel. I just think that this perpetuation of wars, creating disorder, chaos, hatred, are the kind of thing that it will be very difficult for Israel to survive over the long haul. I think that if we put this in some historical context, we can understand what I have called in one of my books the scarred psyche of the Jewish people, and I think we do have that. But once again, let me say that the scarred psyche of the Jewish people, I mean, Yitzhak Rabin in his inaugural address said one of the great forgotten speeches of our time said that we have to forget that. All of this is behind us. The world is not against us. We have friends. We have admirers throughout the world. And yet Israel continues to behave as, well, Rabin was assassinated, as you know, by a religious extremist, or Jewish religious extremist. And the ideas that he had come to represent, ideas which I must say he didn't have in his younger days, only as a reflective elder man did this happen, all of those ideas have now gone down the drain. And whoever said there is no peace process, well, there ain't no peace process at the moment. There is only a situation that is growing increasingly chaotic.
But the Israeli people, when they hear the head of Iran say that he wants to wipe them off the face of the earth, and there are pretty well-established links between Iran and both Hamas and Hezbollah, so don't they have a reason to be...
I mean, Ahmadinejad has certainly stirred things up, I think, both rhetorically and by probably sending a lot more than we understood to the Hezbollah forces in South Lebanon. And I think that we have helped him grow stronger in many ways. We, the United States, have helped him grow stronger in many ways practically forcing the Shiite segment of Iraq into his embrace. So there is some fear, a genuine fear on the part of Israelis that what has happened has only made the Shiite crescent of the Middle East a much more powerful foe. It seems to me that one of the responses to that might be to try to find some common ground. Ahmadinejad has not made it easy. Hamas has not made it easy. Hezbollah has not made it easy. But on the other hand, neither have the Israelis made it easy. And so I think that we have two stubborn sides here, which might perhaps under a different regime in Washington at least have come to a standstill in their animosities while they sparred around, while they explored openings to one another. We have in Washington exactly the opposite, one that is stirring up the worst on both sides.
Well, indeed, I'm sure the president and Condoleezza Rice are getting an earful as we speak, because prior to her going off on this trip to Israel, then she's going to meet with Abbas and then go to Rome. She's meeting today, as is the president, with the Saudi delegation, and clearly the Saudis are concerned about the Shia crescent, and I think they recognize that they're in a struggle for who is the custodian of Islam, given that they are the custodians of the two shrines in Mecca and Medina. And it seems it's also worth reminding us, even though they came out against Hezbollah, they also tried to kill Hezbollah some time back in the mid-80s when Ronald Reagan was president. It was an intelligence operation that went badly. They blew up, I think they killed about 100 people in South Beirut, but they didn't get Nasrallah, their target, the Hezbollah leader.
Well, you know, let's face it. I mean, the Saudis, there is one side of the Saudi outlook which is profoundly anti-Shiite, because a third or a fourth of the population of Saudi Arabia is Shiite. And now the Iraqi government has become increasingly Shiite, and it is become much more of a threat to Saudi Arabia, to the Sunni Wahhabi regime in Saudi Arabia. So this is indeed a situation which is growing worse. On the other hand, Saudi Arabia is still Arab. I think it sees what's happening in Iraq today as catastrophic. It doesn't much see anything in it for themselves in what's happening in Lebanon. And if there's an opportunity for the Saudis, who God knows have made a lot of trouble by promoting their Wahhabi doctrine around the world, and one of the indirect products of which is Osama bin Laden. At the same time, there is a side of the Iraqi political culture which says, look, it is not in our interest to promote this kind of chaotic animosity between Arabs. And so I think they have a strong interest in trying to put an end to this. Now, whether they can figure out a way to impose this, impress President Bush with this, I don't know. It's going to be a very hard job because we have a president who is not very open to fresh ideas.
Well, just in closing, Milton Vuost, everything that the Israeli military and the government spokespeople have been saying about what their intentions are in Lebanon doesn't make any sense militarily. I mean, they're saying they're degrading the inventory of Hezbollah rockets. Well, hello, inventory can always be replaced, and we do live in an era of asymmetrical warfare where the best military in the world in Iraq is tied down by IEDs, and Hezbollah seems to be able, in spite of the military incursion, which I don't believe is a very large one, it's been exaggerated by our irresponsible so-called correspondents getting all lathered up over it, but I think it's a limited incursion so far. But they have
limited ground incursion.
Yeah, ground incursion.
Well, so far the Israelis have taken the position that they don't want to go into Lebanon if they can do it, because they recognize something of the dangers. But in fact, they are doing the same thing they did in 1982. They went in 1982 convinced that they could destroy the infrastructure of the PLO and the Palestinian problem would be solved forever. Well, they did destroy much of the infrastructure of the PLO, and the Palestinian political power came back stronger than it has ever been, and it remains powerful today, largely because of this horrible misconception of why they went into Lebanon in 1982. Well, the fact is, I think that might very well happen now, that Lebanon will just become a site of a far stronger, far more hostile, far more powerful threat to Israel, one that it has created for itself. But the Israelis, you know, in my judgment, have continued to make mistakes through all of this. There is no doubt in my mind that when Hamas was elected a few months ago in the most free election ever conducted in the Arab world, not only were the Israelis unwilling to accept Hamas, and I think were convinced that they had to destroy it, but once again, they received all the encouragement they needed from the United States, and what we are seeing now is the consequence of that.
So in 82, to get rid of the PLO, they open up a worse can of worms, and in effect, creating Hezbollah. And if you apply Newton's law to geopolitics, for every
not only did they create Hezbollah, but they created, if you will recall, one intifada after another, mm-hmm. and there hasn't what started out during certain intervals with prospects of peace certainly became worse and worse as the Palestinians recognized for the first time their potential in this asymmetrical warfare.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Milton Vuost.
Thanks, Ian. Nice to be with you.
Good to be with you. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Milton Vuost, who's covered the Middle East as a journalist and scholar since the 1960s. He was the New Yorker's Middle East correspondent, and he's written six books on the Middle East. His latest is Storm from the East, The Struggle Between the Arab World and the Christian West. I'm now speaking with Jahan Salehi, who was born in Iran, raised and educated in the United States, and he has was the managing director of the European operations of the Los Angeles Times Syndicate, and based in London from 2001 to 2003. He is now currently the international director of Agence Global, which is a new syndicate specializing in the Middle East. And he just returned from Iran, where he's been for the last month. And we were talking earlier with Rami Khoury about the notion that that we in the United States don't speak to evil. We don't negotiate with North Korea, Syria, even though the president in the open mic the other day acknowledged that Syria was the only people that they needed to talk to and to contain and control Hezbollah. We don't speak to Iran, of course. So, and it's interesting to note that in that only other mission accomplished moment that took place in the Iraq War was when the statue of Saddam came down. That was on April the 10th of 2003. Apparently, the government in Iran sent emissaries through back channels to the White House. They were concerned that they'd be next, and they basically told the Bush administration that we want to talk, everything's on the table, and we have authority from the Supreme Leader to speak and touch on all of our bilateral problems. And Dick Cheney gave the Iranian delegation the back of his hand because we don't speak to evil. And of course, at the moment when we had maximum leverage over this Iranian government that seems to be causing this administration so much trouble, we basically, as I say, gave them the back of the hand, and now, in many ways, Iran vis-a-vis Iraq seems to be in the driver's seat. So, irony of ironies, wouldn't you say?
Ian. Is
yes.
That directed at me?
yes. Well, I guess it was more somewhat rhetorical, but...
It is rhetorical, but you're absolutely right. I mean, the Rami's point earlier when I was listening was the most salient point in this, is that basically we have a Secretary of State flying to the Middle East to speak with everyone but the people that can really actually make a difference in this current crisis, meaning that we don't speak to evil, but we don't also speak to any of the direct representatives of evil who we then immediately publicly announce are the real culprits in this current crisis, meaning that if it's Syria and Iran that are behind this, then the idea that we might want to speak with Syria and Iran from a diplomatic standpoint seems obvious to most of us, but not apparently to our government. And there are reasons for that. I mean, I think that this is not a crisis that we want to see resolved immediately in terms of America's interests, and it's not a crisis that Israel, of course, wants to see halted or resolved immediately either. There are still a lot of goals to be accomplished militarily. And then the question that's been raised several times on this program is whether or not those military goals will accomplish the political goals or ultimately the stability and peace-seeking goals that everyone states they want. And I, like many of your guests, don't believe that history has shown us that Israel's current actions and America's support for those actions are going to, in the long term, resolve anything.
But do you think, Jahan, that there is a... You mentioned the United States may have another agenda here. Could it be that, as some CIA analysts have suggested to me some time ago, that when at the time when Cy Hirsch was writing these articles about the DOD plans to invade Iran, it was mentioned that in order to, if as a precursor to invading Iran, you'd have to take care of Hezbollah because Iran has the ability to unleash Hezbollah as a kind of deterrent against attack. So, are you suggesting that there's something broader going on here
No, I don't, and I'm not suggesting that this is a conspiracy of any form, or that this was planned by either the U.S. or Israel as an attempt at disabling or disarming a one political option for Iran. On the other hand, as the chain of events unfolded, and my take on that is very different from what you're hearing in either the Western press or even much of European press. My take is that this was a faction of Hezbollah that was not working closely with either the head of Hezbollah, Sheikh Nasrallah, or with Syria or with Iran, and that this attack, the July 12th attack, was actually a surprise for both Syria and Iran, and that they are then forced to go along with. In essence, they have to. They do give considerable support, to the tune of $100 to $200 million a year, to Hezbollah and weapons and a tremendous amount of propaganda support. But that this was not something that was initiated by Iran, which has been very careful about walking a line between giving public propaganda support for the actions, which is very popular in the Arab world, but pretty unpopular, by the way, in Iran, and. And then from both Iran and Syria standpoint, this is not a healthy situation. This is not a. There's no good outcomes from this thing, really, for either country. But from the U.S., I mean, the real winners in this, as you pointed out, are really the U.S. and Israel, at least short term. They really believe that this military option can provide them with a number of things. One is that for the U.S., they have a proxy fighter in the war on terrorism, knocking out one of the actors that that Iran supports and that Iran has used as a threatening club. Iran has made statements that are not even thinly veiled about the fact that if the U.S. attacks Iran, which, by the way, I think has a 0% possibility, and most Iranian analysts and most European and American analysts would agree, I don't think there are compelling other reasons why the U.S. is not going to launch an attack on Iran. But yes, Iran said, you know, you attack us and we will unleash the dogs of Hezbollah and whatever influences we have elsewhere. Now, this has been great in terms of reception in the Arabic world. This hasn't, by the way, been very popular in Iran. Most Iranians, the average Iranian in the street, doesn't want to hear any more about funding for the tune of $200 million or $50 million or $300 million to the PLO or to Hamas or to Hezbollah. They're much more concerned about their own domestic problems and so forth. So I don't think that this was a conspiracy on anyone's part. I think this was an action that was misguided by both Hezbollah, and the reaction was extremely misguided by Israel. And I think the U.S. right now is riding along on a sloppy mid-ground where they support Israel both materially and politically, but that this is not going to accomplish long-term goals in terms of having Iran back down in any way or having Iran be less defiant, if those are the goals that the U.S. State Department envisions as perhaps coming out of a weakening Hezbollah. Those are misguided. That's not going to happen.
So then it was a coincidence that on the eve of the G8 summit, where Iran was very much on the agenda and Iran was about to be referred to the United Nations Security Council, that this took place. I mean,
yes, I do think it was absolutely a coincidence. I don't believe that there's any evidence that anyone's. By the way, they would love to find Israel and Israeli intelligence and U.S. intelligence would love to find some sort of real, the guiding hand of Iran in the background. And you're just not going to find that. I mean, the closest thing you've got, even if we point out the fact that the anti-ship missile was a C-802 that Hezbollah used to shoot at the Israeli gunboat, absolutely, Iran supplies Hezbollah with Katyusha rockets and C-808s, 802s, and FAJ-3 and FAJ-5 missiles. But that doesn't mean at all that they planned this thing or that they executed it as a distraction for the nuclear crisis. If you read Iranian press regularly, you'll see that not only are they making public statements that state that that Iran will not send troops to Lebanon and that Iran will not officially sort of have a hand directly in this, they're making those statements despite the fact that there are sort of the Iranian Hezbollah factions that can make public statements that are, by the way, refuted by official Iranian statements about how they are ready to send fighters right now to Lebanon. They've been saying that with every anti-Israeli conflict or other Israeli-Palestinian conflict for the last 25 years. So this is not a conspiracy. This is not this wasn't planned out by Iran to distract from the nuclear crisis. Now, having said that, everything about this in terms of possible outcomes, I think, is going to eventually strengthen Iran's hand. I don't believe that disabling Hezbollah's military effectiveness in the south of Lebanon is going to somehow reduce Iran's importance. Quite the opposite. I think that Iran's importance in the Muslim world in general is being enhanced by their strong vocal support for Hezbollah and Hezbollah's actions. Even if Hezbollah is very severely wounded by this, it'll simply aid them. And the other client states, or the, let's say, the friendly Arab governments for the U.S., coming out with criticisms of Hezbollah, which are very unpopular in their own countries. In Egypt, it's not at all popular to hear that that this was Hezbollah's fault and Israel's not to blame for this thing. That's not at all a popular statement in the street. And actually, there's a joke I think I read somewhere that states that right now Ahmadinejad is more popular in Egypt than he is in Iran.
Yeah.
And I believe that. I think that these are statements made by Ahmadinejad for political purposes internally, but also in terms of his vision of seeing a broader appeal of Iran to the centricity of Muslims in the Middle East.
Well, as we speak, Jahan Salehi, the President and Condoleezza Rice are meeting with Saudi officials, presumably, and they have made these statements castigating Hezbollah for provoking this crisis. And as you just pointed out, that is not necessarily playing well in the street, and perhaps not in the street in Saudi Arabia itself. The Saudis also were subcontracted out to kill Nasrallah some time back when President Reagan was mired in Beirut, and that ended up not killing Nasrallah but killing about 100 innocents. Killed. So that leads me to the main question here, which is what is really going on here between the Saudis and the Iranians, given that we appear to have a civil war in Iraq that perhaps is already a surrogate war between the Shia and their Iranian patrons and the Sunni and their Saudi and Gulf and Jordanian and Egyptian patrons. Is this struggle, therefore, over something bigger, like who is the custodian of Islam?
The custodian of Islam battle has been going on for almost 3 decades, or 2.5 decades, let's say. Yes, absolutely. There is absolutely no love lost between the Saudi family and the Saudi government and Tehran. This is a matter where every passing decade seems to give the Shiite minorities in Iraq and in other countries a leg up with Iran making grounds in terms of defiance of the superpowers, of supporting massive military and funding injections into the PLO. They were the first ones to step forward immediately to tell Hamas that they would give them money to replace the money that was being withheld after the elections. Iran has certainly raised its stature in the eyes of Sunni Muslims, but certainly as a champion for all Shiite Muslims around the world. But I'm not at all a proponent of the notion of the terrible fear of a Shia crescent coming around the Middle East, in part because that Shia crescent notion is a false one. There's not going to be a Shia Syria, let's say. But the idea that the populist movements that have once oppressed minorities or large groups of Arab groups in Iraq is the most pertinent example right now, is that I think that what's happening in Iraq with a large, formerly silent group of Shia now is taking a prominent role in that country and with massive street protests and also dissent within, let's say, Egypt or Saudi Arabia. I think that you really, if I had to gamble on what Arab governments are going to fall the next decade, I'd give you good odds on Saudi Arabia and Egypt. And I think that those are two countries that are looking around and saying, well, who are our friends in this area? And there are a precious few. These are not Arab governments that represent their own people and that are responding as, these are not democracies that are admired by other Arabs in the area or their own people. And Iran, for all of its faults, is seen as a democracy by most Middle Easterners, and that they're seen as a democracy that's fervently Islamic and that seems to be championing the Palestinians in an unequivocal way, in a way that neither Egypt nor Saudi Arabia has done, and certainly Jordan hasn't. So I think in many, many ways, the PR war for the average Muslim mind, whether it's from North Africa all the way down to Indonesia, is being won more by the Shia government in Tehran, but not because they're Shias, but because they make the right political statements. And I think there's a tremendous amount of economic despair and dissent and a real sense of humiliation and shame on the part of Muslims all over at the way Israel and the U.S. managed to act militarily in the Middle East. And I think the only person, the only country they see as being defiantly out there in the face of it and able to face down the U.S. and Israel is Iran. That plays well in those countries. Now, do I think that that's beneficial in the long term for the stability of the region? No, I don't, actually. I think that Iran would, in fact, welcome a dialogue with the U.S. They've not only said so, but I think they're acting as if that, and they've done it for years. They've done it for decades. And I think that somewhere in here we have to keep asking the question that Rami Khoury keeps asking, is where is the diplomacy? Where is the role of diplomacy?
Sure.
And that's really absent in this whole fiasco. And that, by the way, is the only way I see any resolution to this.
Well, it's sort of interesting. Bob Baer, the CIA fellow, he described the letter that Ahmadinejad sent to Bush as a surrender document. And, of course, Ahmadinejad in that document says that religious democracy is the way of the future. You've just been in Iran. Just in closing, then, it's a much more nuanced polity than we give it credit for, and that Ahmadinejad is not entirely popular in some quarters. But unfortunately, the movement to bring about more democracy in Iran, which was well underway before the United States invaded Iraq, I believe instead of severing the young and the women from the mullahs, in effect, the United States has unwittingly driven them back into the embrace of the mullahs, and nobody in Iran wants to be liberated by the United States if Iraq is a model. So where would you put the situation in terms of, is there any way internally that Ahmadinejad can be moderated?
Oh, I think your points are exactly right. I think that every threat that comes from the U.S. about possible attacks on Iran helps to bolster Ahmadinejad's position internally. He is not a popular politician, and he has serious problems within the conservative elements of Iranian society, within the broad younger population, with women who don't really see him as being the biggest problem. By the way, he's not particularly a problem for women as opposed to, let's say, the really reactionary clerics who worry about hijab. If you talk to the average person, and I did for a long time, for many weeks traveling around Iran, I spoke with taxi drivers and blue-collar workers and women and students and so forth, and the overwhelming reaction was, Ahmadinejad is a good or bad leader for us based on the economic results he can bring for us. Overwhelmingly, when I try to talk about, how do you feel about the poor Palestinians and so forth, overwhelmingly Iran's population right now, young and old, are concerned about what's happening with the Iranian economy. They would love to have Iran have bigger trading partners, more trading partners, have the U.S. Everything in Iran is still geared towards America in terms of every product is in English and the biggest brands are American brands, rather humorously. I mean, you can't buy Iranian-branded candy and gum and clothing. It's all American brands. And the younger population in Iran still idolizes America. I was treated extremely well traveling all over Iran as an American. And it's an irony that Iranian population would love to see dialogue, open economic ties, more cultural links, the whole bit. And yet the real undermining of Ahmadinejad would come by, in essence, opening up those communications, going in and supporting a tremendous loosening of the restrictions and the sanctions. And that would undermine him, because that would give his critics and his opponents room to, in essence, expand their support within the younger crowds. So that's what's happening. I think you're absolutely right.
I'm afraid we've run out of time, and I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you for having me.
Jahan Salehi, who is the international director of Agence Global, which is a news syndicate specializing in the Middle East. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Rusty Wynn, associate producer, Carol Kurt, the assistant producer. And I thank the engineer today, Melissa Figueroa. This program and all previous ones are available at ianmasters.org.